Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 10, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federal Society's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Update Teleforum for June. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome back two experts who should be pretty well known to everyone on the call, Wayne Abernathy, who is the Executive VP for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association, and Julius Jerry Lozier, who is of counsel at Winston & Strawn. We're going to have a presentation by both of our experts, and then with any leftover time, we'll take your questions. So without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Wayne Abernathy to get us started. So Wayne, go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much. And I believe at this time of day, it's safe for me to say good afternoon to everyone in the lower 48. And for everybody generally, welcome to this call. This is the continuation of a series that we began several months ago. Again, my name is Wayne Abernathy, and I'm joined here by my colleague Jerry Lozier of Counsel Winston & Strawn, joining us from Chicago. Both of us are members of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group. Jerry leads our working group on the Consumer Bureau and keeps a very close eye on the many activities taking place at the Bureau and involving the Bureau. This teleform, as I mentioned, is the latest of what now has become a series. I think we're coming close to 8 or 9 of these updates on the activities for the new Consumer Bureau. Since our update last month, Jerry has cataloged 35 notable Bureau events and activities through June 9. We have to put a deadline on it at some point, so these are up until the beginning of this week. Today we will focus on several, and I could almost say many, of some of the most notable, after which we'll be happy to take calls to discuss any of these issues further or go into other items that we do not mention but which may be of particular interest to you, which you think that others should take note of as well. To begin with, I'll lead off with an announcement that the Bureau made on May 22nd. This is something that all the regulators have to do, and that is to provide a rulemaking agenda, which is a list of, as best as they can determine at this point or are willing to disclose to the public, of what issues and regulatory matters they're going to be taking up in the near future. And on that May 22nd announcement, the Bureau listed 9 particular rules that they consider to be major initiatives, and these are the rules that they plan to take up. Most of them are in connection with assignments given under the Dodd-Frank Act, although some of them are issues that the Bureau has since determined on its own ticket to take up and to focus on. They include changes to rules involving HMDA, and that's under the Dodd-Frank Act that requires that the various categories for disclosures under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, HMDA, be expanded. The Bureau has a proposal to expand those disclosures even further. Another issue is an assignment from Dodd-Frank Act to the Bureau to combine the disclosures under the Truth in Lending Act and the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, TILA-RESPA, which the Bureau now calls TRID, T-R-I-D. Third item is follow-up to the mortgage rules that the Bureau has published. Also on their list are prepaid financial products, for which they have published an outline of the issues that they're looking at and some of the thoughts that they are willing to share with the public about where they're headed, perhaps, in their rulemaking. Payday lending, overdrafts, and by overdrafts I mean debit, deposit account overdrafts. Large participants in auto lending, and if we were going to include today in our list of items, but we will save this for our next call, the Bureau did announce today a proposal for including non-bank auto lenders under their aegis and have a regulatory program for them, debt collection practices, and then finally, and 9th on their list is arbitration. So the Bureau has a very busy schedule ahead of themselves, and I think we'll have much to talk about in the days, weeks, and months to come. With that list, let me now pass the microphone on to Jerry Lozier, who's going to talk to us about that TILA-RESPA integration program, or TRID, and its effective date. Jerry.
Right. Thank you very much, Wayne. For those who aren't expert in this area, TILA-RESPA, TILA is the Truth in Lending Act, and it requires that lenders make certain disclosures to borrowers. RESPA is the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, which also requires that other disclosures be made to mortgage borrowers, particularly regarding closing costs. For years, the Federal Reserve and Department of Housing and Urban Development worked and tried to integrate the two different types of disclosures into a single type of disclosure document without any real success. And the CFPB finally did so once it was created, and its new rule goes into effect August 1st. However, there have been publicized surveys, one of them that came out last month, that suggests that 41% of mortgage lenders will not be ready on August 1st. And last month in May, the 250 congressmen, both Republicans and Democrat, wrote to CFPB Chairman Cordray asking for a five-month grace period until January 1, 2016 for compliance with the new rule. And on May 14th, a House subcommittee held a hearing on this subject, the effective date of the new rule, and members called for a grace period. Subcommittee Chairman Blaine Lutkemeyer, who's a Republican from Missouri, wrote CFPB Chairman Cordray asking that he restrain enforcement until January 1, 2016. But at the hearing, Chairman Cordray said that the CFPB considered a January 1 effective date, but was concerned that lenders had other system programming demands as of that date, so instead that they opted for August 1. There's a subcommittee member named Steve Pierce, who's a Republican from New Mexico, and he and Brad Sherman, a congressman from California, a Democrat, have introduced H.R. 2213, which would require the CFPB to create a temporary safe harbor for enforcement of this new rule until January 1. The concern, obviously, is that, like the CFPB's qualified mortgage rule, this rule could drive lenders out of the market if they're having a difficult time complying by August 1. They may stop making mortgage loans because you've got to set up, you essentially have to have two sets of computer programming, one that will work until July 31 at midnight and then be able to throw a switch and have a whole new set of computer programming at 12:01 a.m. on August 1st. But the end of the story is that on June 3rd, Chairman Cordray wrote to the 250 congressmen who had written him and said, no, there will be no delay and no grace period, but the CFPB will consider good faith compliance efforts. But the problem I think that a lot of people see out there is that even if the CFPB recognizes good faith efforts to comply, private plaintiffs, class action lawyers, may not do so. And if you're part of the 41% who will not be ready by August 1, you could find yourself defendant in plaintiff class actions. And so this looks like it's going to be a real problem for the industry because the CFPB is sort of intransigent on this August 1 date. Wayne, I'll turn it over to you to talk about overdraft fees.
Great. Thank you very much, Jerry. Yes, overdraft fees. This has been a topic that from the creation of the Bureau in various different statements and speeches, the Bureau has indicated has been something they've been very concerned about and has been doing a significant amount of research and study with some concerns as to the practices, fees, costs, and so forth. On the 29th of May, one of the core processors that provides overdraft services, particularly to community banks, sent an email message to its clients notifying them that the Bureau had come to Fiserv requesting a significant amount of data in connection with the overdraft practices and services of its clients and wanted that information sent by FISERV to the Bureau. We have since understood that similar requests went to the other two core processors that are make significant markets in overdraft products for banks, FIS and also Jack Henry. FISERV in particular, though, mentioned that the cost would be significant for the company and for its employees, and that therefore FISERV intended to pass the costs of that data dump to its customers. The Bureau made it clear that they were not going to pay for the information that they were requiring. They were just going to ask and demand the information. Section 1022 of the Dodd-Frank Act gives the Bureau very extensive authority to request, one could say demand, information in connection with consumer financial products. It's clear that that applies to insured depository institutions, banks and credit unions. Its extension to other firms, a little bit questionable, and there are some that have raised potential constitutional questions with regard to a requirement to that it goes out to parties that are not insured financial institutions. That could be an interesting discussion for another day, but the important point here is that it's a very significant amount of data, and FISERV pointing out that they're not being reimbursed by the Bureau for providing the information, intends to pass those costs on to its clients, which are a variety of community banks. One further point that I'd make in connection with the overdraft issue is on June 5th, there was a Bloomberg Business story that reported that the Bureau had significantly narrowed the field of likely rulemaking in connection with overdraft. In the past, there were a number of issues that the Bureau indicated they were looking at and where they thought there might be significant problems. According to this Bloomberg Business study, the Bureau is focusing their area for rulemaking on the order in which checks and not only debits but also credits are processed, and also may be focusing on disclosures that are given to consumers, that they're not currently looking at capping overdraft fees or limiting the frequency of access to overdrafts that customers might avail themselves of. You might be aware that the FDIC, for example, requires banks to contact any of their customers who in the previous 12 months have more than six overdrafts on their deposit account, and provide various information and make inquiries to make sure that their customers know what they're doing. Apparently that, at least according to the Bloomberg Business Report, those kinds of things are not currently on the agenda for the Bureau to do some rulemaking on. We'll certainly have to see what happens. The Bureau, as we mentioned, has overdrafts on their list for rulemaking in the future, probably in the fall. With that, let me turn the microphone back over to Jerry, who's going to talk to us about telecom settlements.
Thank you, Wayne. You know, historically, over the last few years, telephone companies have been accused of a practice called cramming, i.e. imposing unauthorized charges on customers on their telephone bills. Normally, you would think that would be a matter for their regulator, the Federal Communication Commission, or maybe the Federal Trade Commission. So we were all surprised a few months ago when the CFPB and the FTC sued Verizon and Sprint for cramming. And on May 12th, the CFPB announced settlements with Verizon and Sprint. Verizon agreed to pay $90 million and Sprint agreed to pay $68 million. And the allegations were that they imposed charges on their telephone bills for apps that consumers really had not bought. Allegedly, consumers were tricked into buying these apps by clicking on online ads or by providing their phone numbers in exchange for free content. In some cases, allegedly, charges were just entirely fabricated. Verizon and Sprint outsourced their payment processing work, but they allegedly did not closely monitor what those processors were doing, although Verizon and Sprint did receive 30% or 40% of the revenue derived from these cramming tactics. What is sort of interesting is that 1 week later, on May 19th, a federal judge in New York, to whom the Sprint settlement was presented, refused to approve it. It turns out that the CFPB and Sprint had filed with the judge a one-sentence joint motion and did not attach a memorandum of law, did not attach any declarations. And the judge chided the CFPB. He said, quote, "It is especially ironic, given the Bureau's core mission as described on its website, to, quote, give consumers the information they need to understand the terms of their agreements," unquote. The federal judges in New York have complained repeatedly about being sort of taken for granted in the case of settlements and being treated like rubber stamps, and so that's sort of what was probably going on there. But it was sort of ironic that the judge was able to complain about the CFPB's failure to disclose details of the settlement agreement to him. Wayne, I'll turn it back to you to talk about the ever-expanding reach of the Bureau.
Great. Thank you very much, Jerry. I want to begin by citing a statement recently by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She was commenting on how she has been occasionally accused of considering the Dodd-Frank Act to be sacrosanct and not worthy of any amendment. And she said that's totally false. She does believe it needs amendment, that it doesn't go far enough. And as one example that she has pointed out, she on May 8th announced that she would like to see the Dodd-Frank Act amended to remove from the Act the exclusion of or the Bureau's authority with regard to automobile dealers. Under the Dodd-Frank Act, the breadth of authority that the Bureau has, while extensive, is specifically walled off from reaching to automobile dealers, particularly automobile dealers in offering financing for the purchase of automobiles. Warren is quoted as saying that auto loans are, quote, the most troubled consumer financial product, end quote. And so she's going to be proposing, or claims that she will, legislation to change that. She may have rough going with that, though. I will mention Congressman Frank Inta of New Hampshire, Republican of New Hampshire, has proposed a bill that's been co-sponsored by 40 congressmen, including 19 Democrats, that would provide and emphasize that the Bureau has absolutely no authority over auto loans originated by auto dealers. So that could be a very interesting kind of debate in Congress. We'll see how that goes. In a related matter, a few days later, at a meeting of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, USPIRG, the Assistant Director of the Bureau's Office of Supervisory Policy, Patty Tuig, who has been with the Bureau since its organization, in a speech, referred to the Bureau's approach with regard to, quote-unquote, big data. And she pointed out that just because legislators have not enacted laws addressing this subject or other subjects, she does not see that as a significant impediment to the Bureau's action in, with regard to big data. And she pointed in particular to the authority under the Dodd-Frank Act for UDAP violations. And by UDAP, that's the UDAAP. Prior to the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act, the FTC and others had some authority over what were unfair and deceptive acts and practices, UDAP with one A. The Dodd-Frank Act extended that authority to the Bureau and added one more letter, UDAAP, which gives the Bureau authority to identify and to take enforcement action against practices that it considers not only unfair or deceptive. In fact, they might consider them not to be unfair or deceptive, but if they are what they consider to be abusive, the new A, then the Bureau is authorized to take action. It's under that new UDAP with two A's authority that Peggy Toohey sees an opportunity for the Bureau to take action where Congress has refrained from taking action. And with that, let me pass it back to Jerry to talk about administrative appeals.
Thank you, Wayne. On June 3rd, Direct CFPB Director Cordray issued his decision on the first administrative appeal that there has been at the CFPB. The case involved PHH Corporation, which is a major mortgage originator and servicer. An administrative law judge had found that PHH had violated RESPA's prohibition on paying kickbacks in connection with residential mortgage loans, and the ALJ fined PHH $6.4 million. Director Cordray, in considering the appeal, agreed that PHH had violated RESPA. However, he disagreed with the penalty, and he increased the penalty from $6.4 million to $109 million. Now, the basis of the violation was that PHH referred borrowers to mortgage insurers who then, in fact, reinsured the insurance policies with affiliates of PHH, and thus were paying premiums for that reinsurance to PHH affiliates, and it's those payments that the CFPB characterized as kickbacks for the referrals of the insurance business. The ALJ based his penalty on each mortgage closed after July 21st, 2008, which I think was probably the date that you could go back on the statute of limitations. So he looked at each mortgage that was closed thereafter. Director Cordray said that was erroneous, that the penalty should be based on each payment that PHH received after July 21, 2008, thus including all of the mortgages that had originated even earlier than July 21, 2008, and that's what increased the penalty. So it wasn't just some ad hominem distaste for an appeal. That was the basis of Director Cordray's decision. There was a rational basis for it. PHH has said it will appeal that decision to a federal appellate court. Wayne, is it time to talk about payday loans?
I think it is, and as many of the issues that we deal with here each month, they're a continuation of stories that we might have treated in earlier broadcasts and earlier issues that the Bureau is continuing to work on, and that's certainly the case with regard to payday loans. The Bureau has had its attention focused on the payday lending industry for some time now, and latest developments in this ongoing debate, we will point particularly to May 28 and June 2nd. On May 28, the credit reporting agency Clarity Services released a report on payday lending and what the impact would be of a recent structure or I guess you'd call it a plan for regulating that the Bureau has published, and as they're in the process of considering what sorts of regulations to put forward in payday lending, and based upon their evaluation of the platform or plans that the Bureau has put forward, their estimate was that the number of loans that would be regulated by that would be reduced by 70%. Similarly, in just the week before that, Charles River Associates released a study where they looked at CFP rules in being considered and under discussion, and their view was that payday loans would be reduced by 82% under the Bureau's guidelines. This is particularly of significance if you believe that there are segments of the economy that have difficulty getting loans through the more traditional banking or other types of venues for whatever reasons, regulatory or otherwise, and yet still have borrowing needs, either for smoothing out their income or dealing with emergencies. This could be a very significant reduction in their access to financing. Those are on May 28. To add to that story, continuing on June 2nd, a very popular publication here in Washington called The Hill, which follows, as one would guess, the Congress and actions there, but also looks at the regulatory world. There was a story published by Brian Wise, who's the senior advisor for the U.S. Consumer Coalition, which lobbies in favor of the payday lending industry. In his article, he pointed out that competing with the payday lending is a product offered by self-help enterprises, which is a subsidiary of the Center for Responsible Lending, which Mr. Martin Eakes founded operating in North Carolina. They make loans, small dollar loans, to low and moderate income people through funding from the U.S. Treasury's Community Development Financial Institutions Fund. Those products would not be affected, curiously, by the framework that the Bureau has proposed with regard to regulating payday loans and similar loans, the suggestion being that since many of Mr. Eek's colleagues and former employees are now working for the Bureau and other regulatory agencies, that it's curious that the proposed framework would affect Mr. Eek's competitors but not Mr. Eek's loans itself. We just present that out there for your information. You can draw your own conclusions. We'll now move to Jerry Loggia to talk to us about solicitation of distress stories by the Bureau.
Thank you, Wayne. Everyone on the call may remember that a couple of months ago, we reported that the CFPB had adopted a final policy to publish unverified narratives of consumer complaints that it receives. And this was, of course, over strenuous industry objections. Well, on June 2nd, in that very same vein, the CFPB invited those with student debt distress stories, quote unquote, to share them by joining a CFPB website called, quote, Thunderclap, unquote. And the stories might include, the CFPB said, payment processing problems, servicing transfer snags, communication breakdowns. And the CFPB said that Thunderclap enables a consumer, quote, to pledge a message from his or her social account to all of his or her followers on the same day and time that others will be sharing the message, unquote. Ironically, on that same day, June 2nd, the Senate Finance Committee was holding a hearing on the data breach at the Internal Revenue Service. And Senator Mike Enzi, a Republican from Wyoming, expressed privacy concerns about the CFPB, quote, collecting everything, unquote. He said people are worried about the NSA, but should be worried about the CFPB and a possible data security breach there. He also, Senator Enzi, also mentioned that when he received his tax refund check from the IRS, there was a flyer in the envelope from the CFPB soliciting stories. He called it advertising of the CFPB and complained that taxpayer dollars were being used to advertise an agency. And he complained to Internal Revenue Service Commissioner John Koskinen, who promised to find out who paid for the flyer and why the flyer was inserted in the IRS envelopes and to report back to Senator Enzi. Wayne, how about the PayPal consent order?
Yes, thank you very much, Jerry. On May 19th, the Bureau filed a complaint and proposed consent order against PayPal. The alleged infraction was PayPal allegedly illegally signed up consumers for online credit products that were for various purchases and other exchanges where the customers didn't receive or were improperly informed about the nature of the product or the payment processes and so forth. The consent order required PayPal to pay $15 million in redress to consumers, that would be paid to the consumers, and also $10 million to the Bureau's Civil Penalty Fund. Under the Dodd-Frank Act, the Bureau maintains a fund called the Civil Penalty Fund, where those monies are to be used by the Bureau to reimburse and to try to some degree, compensate victims of various financial abuses that they have been targeted by financial entities, and that's what this fund is for. I will note that that $10 million assigned to the Bureau, I'd compare that to another report that the Bureau made on May 12th, the Inspector General for the Bureau, noted that the Bureau during 2014 had dispersed from this fund just under $1 million to harmed consumers. So either this is 10 times the amount of money that was available in 2014, or somehow or another, the money just doesn't seem to get out of the Bureau's fund and end up in the hands of the aggrieved parties. Again, probably an area for more research and investigation. There have been a lot of concerns by folks on Capitol Hill that the fund either doesn't actually go to help aggrieved parties, and or it's used to somehow benefit friends and lovers of the Consumer Bureau. Well, we'll see. Certainly something that requires closer scrutiny, I believe. And now the last issue we want to touch on today before we go to questions from callers. Jerry, talk to us about reverse mortgage advertising.
Okay, and I'll be very brief, Wayne. On June 4th, the CFPB announced the results of a study it conducted on advertising of reverse mortgages, and its study results were very widely reported. It found that consumers are very confused about reverse mortgages, that consumers think that reverse mortgages are some kind of government benefit, and also that reverse mortgages enable consumers to stay in their homes the rest of their lives. The CFPB simultaneously issued an advisory on reverse mortgages, and what I thought was of interest is that apparently the basis of the CFPB study was only 60 interviews that it conducted in only 3 cities. So that's all I have, Wayne.
Great, and with that, I believe we're ready to go to questions and comments from our callers.
All right. Well, in a moment, you will all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And while we're waiting for the first questions to come on, I do want to do a quick programming note. For those of you that are in the Washington, D.C. Area, next Thursday, June 18th, we are having our third annual Executive Branch Review Conference here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel. It is free to attend, and it has turned into an all-day conference. So if you're in the area or want to commit or want to stop in, you can find out more information on our website at fedsoc.org. So again, if you'd like to ask a question about anything we've discussed or anything else that with the Bureau that you might be curious about of one of our experts, press star and then the pound key.
Jerry, while we're waiting for people to raise questions with us, I thought I'd mention one item here to you and get your thoughts on it as well. I noticed that on May 20, the Bureau announced the launching of its financial coaching initiative, which is designed to create, I guess they've announced that they're placing 60 certified financial coaches, they're credited by the Association for Financial Counseling and Planning Education, around the country to help recently transitioned veterans and economically vulnerable consumers. I noticed, I'm just looking at the numbers. The numbers show that there are 250,000 service members leaving active duty each year, and I'm wondering how thinly spread these 60 financial coaches are going to be to address the supposed needs of the 250,000 service members. I think it's basically just a little more than one coach per State of the Union. Any thoughts you have on that?
Wayne, congratulations to you. I did not put those two numbers together. I did see those numbers, but I didn't put them together. That is absolutely right. So that's about one coach for every 4,000 service members. Am I right on that? I think that's right.
Well, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So I guess they will be very, very busy, it sounds like.
Yep. I guess certainly they expect to have well here was another one that I saw, another outreach that they were going to do with regard to distress that they saw from what was another one, loan originators, I think maybe that's what it was, that they were trying to outreach to some of these individuals to help them deal with the various mortgage concerns. But I guess the point overall is some of these things seem to be more window dressing than actually solving problems. That certainly seems to be the case here. And I'm wondering if that might also be the case with the Civil Penalty Fund, which they've created the fund. They do some reimbursement, some compensation, but most of it just never seems to get out to where the real problems are.
Wayne, I'm reminded, though, of the editorial in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago about that fund and about how the problem is that the CFPB sees all these victims out there when they assess these penalties, but then when it comes time to actually disburse the money and identify real life victims, there aren't any. there yeah. are very few, much fewer than the CFPB thought there were.
Yeah. In another area of overpromising, I noticed that the Bureau has been working with the Secretary of Education with regard to student lending. And they had a May 14 announcement together where they're talking about student lending and talking about distressed borrowers. We certainly know there are plenty of distressed borrowers in the student lending area. Mm-hmm. Curious, one of the panelists on a panel that they were in, had discussing this noted that most student loan borrowers, most of them, the majority of them, are complying with their loan needs, but that there's significant defaults with those who drop out of school. The curious thing, though, is that the Undersecretary of Education, Ted Mitchell, set a goal for a zero default rate on student loans, which I guess would move student loans from being the most seriously defaulted form of credit in the country today to making it the safest, probably on a par with the federal government.
Very good. Very good point. And I don't know how this fits into it, but of course, in the last couple of days, we've had the headlines about, as a consequence of the Corinthian problems, the Department of Education forgiving student loan indebtedness, which could cost the taxpayer billions of dollars in debt forgiveness, not just in the case of Corinthian, but apparently it's for any student who apparently might have been misled or defrauded into seeking the college education and then not being able to find a job.
That is astonishing.
Yeah.
We've got a good number of people on the call, but a particularly quiet audience this afternoon. I do want to do one more quick programming note. Our next telephone conference call dealing with patents, assessing the new administrative procedures for challenging patents, will be at 1 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow. And a reminder to just always check our website at fedsoc.org, as we are always adding new telephone conference calls almost on a daily basis, so you can keep up with what we're doing. It looks like we did have one question jump on the line.
Please go ahead. Hey, caller, go ahead and ask your question or make your comment.
Hello, yeah, sorry, I pressed the mute button and it didn't unmute.
Been there myself. Go ahead.
It seems to me that that these funds that are being created by these massive fines just aren't getting to anybody who they're supposed to be compensating. It would be better to leave these fines in some sort of an escrow, or, I mean, is there any effort to notify any of these supposed people who have been identified by these abuses by these agencies, or are these just funds that are going into the general funds or being used to compensate friends and lovers?
Well, curiously, and I think Jerry pointed to some degree, some of these penalties, some of these abuses that have been identified, it's very hard to find the victims. One of the cases I would point out with regard to some of the auto lending, with regard to disparate impact cases that the Bureau has raised, they're having a terrible time trying to identify the people who have been hit with exceptionally high interest rates under disparate impact doctrine. And in fact, their own statistics demonstrated that they were as likely to find white males with excessively high interest rates under their findings as they would minority or women groups. And so part of it is having trouble finding real, genuine victims. But the second part is also what you kind of point to. If they cannot distribute these funds to real victims, then the Bureau is allowed to use this money for, quote-unquote, financial education and consumer education purposes, where at least the opportunity for cronyism seems to be very high.
Yeah, also
Jerry,
a little bit
comments?
Of grandstanding. We obtain these huge funds for you, the consumer,
yeah.
how's the consumer ever going to get these funds? Wouldn't it be a better form of recompense to notify all these alleged victims? Perhaps a defense to these consumer actions would be to say, all right, you show us where the problem. Well, of course, I guess the discovery has to be done, has to come from the institutions themselves. And so the institutions would have to identify the victims before. There's got to be better safeguards here to get the money to the victims.
Traditionally,
being identified, they should also be notified that they're being considered these victims.
Well, yeah, one would think so, and certainly with regard to many other agencies, because of those very significant problems of identifying, dispersing the funds, and so forth, they've given up on the idea of having these kinds of funds and just put the money back into the general treasury, at least to pay down the deficit to some degree. That's what most agencies do. This is a particularly open and broad experiment with regard to the Bureau. I will point out, and it seems to me it's a related thing, is the Bureau also, under the direction of the Dodd-Frank Act, is having a serious inquiry into arbitration practices on the part of financial institutions, where they resolve differences under arbitration. And in a recent study that the Bureau put forward, the Bureau came forward with a curious conclusion that class action lawsuits seem to benefit customers far better than arbitration does. But I think with regard, again, to class action lawsuits, even there you have, once again, a very difficult time of taking the settlement resources from a particular class action suit and putting them really in the hands of the aggrieved parties.
Yeah, most of them go to the lawyers. And then
most of them do, yeah.
It goes to the aggrieved parties. The idea that the... I'm having a little trouble.
They're not unrelated. Yeah, they're very similar,
yeah.
I think, problems.
Oh, yeah. Also, the business that arbitration is required by most of these contracts means, and I think there was just a recent court decision which said that if there is arbitration in the contract, that overrides your rights to do any kind of a court action. And so now you've got this decision by the board showing that the bank was at fault, showing that their charges to you were wrongful, and you've got no way to take that and put it into the arbitration, or do you?
Well, that's a very interesting one. Jerry, you have any comments on that?
You know, I was trying to think real fast. I would think that you would be able to put that into the, if the arbitration was currently pending, or if you subsequently made a claim against, just thinking out loud, I don't know if this makes sense or not, but I guess if I was a consumer and I read about a fine imposed by the CFPB on a company I did business with, and I felt wronged, I guess I would write to the company and to the CFPB, and hopefully between the two of them, I would get some recompense. But I don't know. It seems it's extraordinary to me. Wayne, you gave the example of the less than $1 million on the PayPal, or $10 million fine on PayPal, but the CFPB has paid out less than $1 million in the in 2014 from this fund. Yeah. That $10 million to PayPal, that's just one of dozens of huge penalties that have gone into that fund. That fund must be approaching $1 billion, and for it to have only paid out less than $1 million is, it's disgraceful, really.
Yeah.
Just thinking about the overdraft fees, it seems to me I left Citibank because of the overdraft charges and opened up an account at EAB, and then Citibank took over EAB and was getting these overdraft charges again. That's why I opened up the Checking Plus account, because I wanted the overdraft fees to come out of that. But every time there's an overdraft, they charge me $10 to move it from one account to the other.
And it's a good thing you have that option. There are some that are very happy to have the overdraft programs and pay the fees. Others who chose not to, they should be able to.
I preferred it when the overdraft program was free, as it was when they started it.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a variety of different programs. One of the things, frankly, some of the programs that banks had offered for free, they were funded by the interchange that banks earned on debit cards. And now that that has been regulated by the Dodd-Frank Act and greatly reduced the revenue that comes from that, many of the free services that banks offer, they can no longer afford. And so they've
There's the interest rates have been suppressed for so many years that there's no revenue coming out of interest rates.
Any other questions you have for us?
Well, that's all I've got at the moment.
Well, great. Thank you very much for calling in. Appreciate your comments. And please do call in and listen in the future.
Oh, Wayne, we did have we have one more question that that jumped on the line.
Please, go ahead. Go ahead, caller.
Good afternoon. This is Kirk Kennedy speaking, and thank you for fielding my question. But it's this. In looking through the the regs and Dodd-Frank and the the recent updates to the United States Code regarding the consumer financial protections in place, it looks like the definitions are crafted such that they really apply to individuals and consumers. But what about companies like in the small to lower middle market, that are like solely owned by, like one shareholder, a couple of shareholders, they're, negotiating and entering into, smaller loans, let's say like $5 million and under, they don't qualify as consumers, but it seems like there's very little protection in terms of, for these types of entities in terms of bank conduct and what banks can and can't do and, the regulations that they're under, like the privacy laws, for instance. The privacy breaches only apply to like consumers. They don't apply to, lower middle market companies. And so just when those companies kind of from a structural standpoint are almost like, they're similar to consumers. So.
Yeah, that what you're pointing to really an interesting boundary question that I presume is going to be resolved over time as we build up some kind of case law. The Bureau was specifically given a mandate only with regard to consumer financial products. It's not clear, though, where the line is drawn. The law does seem to suggest that the Bureau is given the authority to define where that line is. So far, they haven't done that. I suspect that they will develop that over time through various cases, but there is not presently any kind of a bright line between when you go from business to consumer financial products. Jerry, you have any comments on that?
Yeah, the only comment I have, Wayne, and it's because I experienced this in my practice, Chris is absolutely right, it's Kirk Kennedy. Yeah,
yes.
Kirk is right that, almost all of these laws, Reg Z, Fair Credit Reporting, apply to individuals' loans for personal household and family purposes, with one exception, and that's Reg B, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, you may remember, does apply to businesses. So a small business is protected against discrimination based on if it's owned by minority or based on nationality, sex, religious orientation, whatever it all is.
And curiously, Jerry, in developing the Dodd-Frank Act authority to the Bureau, Reg B was passed over to the Bureau, but it's not clear if Congress intended that only the consumer portion of that go under the Bureau or the business portion. That's where that boundary may be, and that's something that remains to be resolved.
Yes, as I was thinking about the answer to Kirk's question, I thought that's a very interesting point that Reg B is the jurisdiction of the CFPB, yet it really does extend beyond consumers.
Very interesting question. Thanks for raising that, Kirk.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye.
And we did have another one pop on, so we'll get right to it.
Excellent. Proceed.
Yeah, Chris Garvey again. Wondering if these settlements are clear in that blame is confessed by the alleged wrongdoer, so that because so many of these agencies, they say, well, we're the person who's paying the fine, the agency that's, or the organization that's paying the fine, does not admit any wrongdoing. They're just paying the fine as a settlement, and that of course makes it harder to go after them as a private or class action litigant. Do these deals have a confession of blame in them?
Jerry, are you aware of anywhere that's taken place?
To be honest with you, no. I don't think they have that in them. I know that that's been a big issue over at the SEC, but I have not heard about that being an issue at all with the CFPB. And it's a good question. I don't know for sure, but my sense is, you know, we would hear that, and CFPB would say they'd have a lot fewer settlements if people had to admit wrongdoing.
So they try to do all their compensation of the victims through the fund rather than enabling the victims to sue on their own.
Mm-hmm. No, not all of that. I noticed, take for example, in the case of the PayPal, you had two sets of funds. You had, as I recall, $15 million that was assigned by PayPal where they had identified customers, where they were to reimburse those customers, where they had the data, they knew who the aggrieved parties were, and the PayPal had an obligation to provide those funds back to those aggrieved parties. Then $10 million of it went into this special fund for, I guess, parties that PayPal couldn't identify, and it's for the Bureau to figure out how to use those funds for the benefit of victims of financial wrongdoing.
But the Bureau has no particular incentive to actually find those people as part of the complaint here.
That's hard work. They don't. If anything, you could say they have an incentive really to keep them at the Bureau so they can use it for funding various Bureau projects. Such as, for example, the financial coaches that I mentioned earlier in the broadcast.
Yeah.
Those are funded out of the out of this particular fund at the Bureau.
Hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Good questions. Thank you. You know, Jerry, and one thing I want to mention that came in my mind in connection with this, I noticed that the Bureau on June 3rd announced they call this a nationwide initiative to provide financial counseling services to disabled workers. They call it the ROADS program, the Reach Outcomes, Achieve Dreams, Succeed. And this nationwide program will operate in 6 communities.
Right. Right.
And I'm wondering, how much of a nationwide program is that?
It's the same point as you made about the 60 financial coaches. It seems awfully faint-hearted, doesn't it?
Yeah, and including one of those areas is the Washington, D.C. metro area, certainly not an underserved or underprotected part of the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And being a Chicagoan, I need to point out that the 6 areas of the country do not include any in the Midwest. It's Austin, Texas, Birmingham, Alabama, Finger Lakes, New York, Seattle, Washington, the entire state of Delaware, and the Washington, D.C. metro area.
Yeah, fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And you know, obviously we'd all agree that counseling the disabled workers is probably a very nice thing and a good thing. But it seems like such a half-hearted effort.
Yeah, much ballyhooed, half-hearted effort.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left, so let's just give our callers one last opportunity to ask a question. So again, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, press star and then the pound key. We'll make this our last call. And again, I want to advertise our Executive Branch Review Conference, which is next Thursday, June 18th, here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel, and attendance is free. And CLE credit will be available in some states for a small fee. So if you're interested in attending, visit our website at fedsoc.org to register. Well, I was going to say, it looks like we don't have any more questions. So Wayne and Jerry, I'll give you guys an opportunity. If you have any concluding thoughts, feel free to give them now. Otherwise, we'll talk to you on the next monthly update.
Let me yield to you, Jerry, for a first round of this.
I really have no conclusions other than to just stay tuned for more developments next month.
And I want to thank Jerry for putting together all these things we've been working from. We're working off of a document that Jerry very studiously puts together during the course of the month. I would point out that some have raised the concerns that the Bureau is bereft of adequate oversight, I will say, at least with regard to the financial services practice of the Federalist Society. We're keeping an eye on what they do and are happy to try to share that information as much as we can. And thank you for listening to us.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Wayne Abernathy and Jerry Lozier, not only for their work on this call, but for the ones that they've done in the past and continue to do. And also add that this year's Executive Branch Review Conference is focused, or is going to be somewhat focused on the role of Congress in overseeing the executive branch. For those of you who are interested in these issues and financial services, the conference will be a great opportunity to explore some of those issues. So until next time, we're adjourned. And the last thing I'll point out is that this telephone call, as well as many of our other telephone conference calls, are recorded and posted as podcasts on the website. So if you missed any part of this or want to go back and review anything you heard, not only do we have the audio available, but also the monthly update is in print form as well on the website for the telephone call. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.